Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poetry Saloncast. I'm your host, Tricia Faye Hefner.
And I'm Callie Grace Thomas.
On each episode, we interview one of our favorite poets to ask what got them started writing.
And what keeps them going.
And my favorite question, what do they do with a rough draft that wants to play rough?
Then we ask for advice that we, and you, our listeners, can use in our own writing practices.
Without further ado, welcome to this week's episode of the Poetry Saloncast.
We are here today with the one and only Tricia Faye Hefner, the Wonder Woman of all things poetry. Tricia, you do so much. You lead one-off workshops. You do editing classes. You do private consulting on manuscripts. And are just an overall incredible literary citizen. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got started?
Oh my gosh. It's a really challenging question. I think I really liked reading the poem The Raven when I was in junior high. And that's my first memory of really writing poetry. But I think it kind of went dormant for a while after that, and I was a performing arts person mainly when I was younger. I really wanted to be in theater. I really wanted to be an actor. And what's actually funny, like hearing you extol my resume there, part of the reason that I decided I didn't want to go into acting. I mean, there were many reasons, but part of it was like just not really being comfortable being a public figure. And I remember this one time I was in the Vagina Monologues in college, which was a load of fun. And I came out of my dorm room one day and another girl was walking by and she just stopped me like on my way to class. And she was this very gentle, soulful looking person. And she looked me in the eye and she's just all, oh, I saw you in the Vagina Monologues. I have to tell you, when you started performing, I just relaxed and I was like, I'm going to let this person, this performer, just take me away. And you really touched me. And it was 9 a.m. in the morning and I was in a hurry on my way to my class and I didn't know this person at all. And she was making direct eye contact with me. And it was so uncomfortable. I'm just like, thank you. Thank you. Please move away. You're making me very uncomfortable right now. And then, of course, I was also like, what's wrong with me? Someone's being nice. I should be able to just take that compliment. But I think it was things like that that made me uncomfortable with the idea of being a performer. And then I also just hate being out of the apartment late at night. And I started taking poetry a little more seriously. There's all these little stories of how it started percolating up. Looking back on it, there were all of these little moments where I was all like, oh, yeah, that was a sign that I really liked poetry. When I was in sophomore year of high school, I learned about the sonnet form. And then for just a year, I would just write sonnets in my notebook every day.
Very impressive for a high schooler.
Yeah.
I was weird. I mean, I think if I were going to boil it down, it's just that I really didn't fit in, but I'm very social, so I wanted to connect with people. Mm. And writing was a way to like connect with my imaginary literary audience. Mm. Or to say things to people that I wouldn't be able to say in person because I was so much of an outcast. And I think there was always some writing going on there. I think when I really fully committed to being a writer and no other thing, it was when I moved to Los Angeles. I wanted to get back into performing arts, and I started taking classes at Upright Citizens Brigade. I think within 6 months, maybe not even that, 3 to 6 months, it just became very clear that I did not fit in with the Hollywood crowd. I could not make friends with people in that group, and I was not feeling successful there in any way. I got my first Pushcart nomination, and I won one of my first poetry awards at that time. I just took that as a sign from the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, universe, you're getting pretty clear here about where I belong and where I don't belong. I'm going to just go back to my writing desk and we'll call it a day.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you were studying with anyone during that time. If you just got a pushcart nomination, you were like, I moved from high school sonnets to pushcart nominations. I'm wondering what the progression was there. And obviously you weren't getting it from the Hollywood crowd, but were you getting guidance from anyone else during that time in terms of poetry?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just trying to like make this succinct, even though it's could be a novel on its own about all the different moves that made me commit deeper and deeper into being a writer. But yeah, I think two big things I can cite is that in AP English, I actually loved writing. I always loved writing, but I did not like poetry. You know, I love novels, I love stories and character development and analyzing a character. And when it came to poetry, I just felt like people were trying to be intentionally vague and I couldn't figure out this puzzle. When we read the William Blake poem, like, "O Rose, thou art sick, the worm does fly into thy bed of crimson joy." I mean, first of all, my friends and I, we all just sat in the back and giggled and we're all like, haha, he's talking about sex. And the rose is a girl and the worm is a boy. But why don't they just come out and say it? Why are they being cryptic? I don't understand this metaphor. And why do I have to understand this metaphor? And I didn't ask to have them talk to me in metaphors. Why do I have to figure this out? And I felt very disengaged with it. And even though I had an awesome AP English teacher, you know, she had us reading William Blake and the Romantics, and they just did not do anything for me. So I was really against poetry until the very last session of my very last class at UC Santa Cruz. We were reading the British canon. We were still with those Romantics. Gosh darn it. And then we started to get into the more modern poets like Yeats. And I think reading The Second Coming was the first time I felt like, oh, that's an interesting poem. I can kind of get behind that one. Then one day I was sitting on a hill at UC Santa Cruz overlooking the ocean. And I was just flipping through the British canon. And I turned to a page in The Way Back. So after we'd gotten past all the Romantics and the old writing and the archaic language into modern poetry, and I read Avon Boland's poem, The Lost Land, which starts out with, I have two daughters. They are all I ever wanted from the earth. Well, almost. I also wanted an island, da-da-da-da-da. And then she goes into this beautiful, beautiful lost world lyrical description of the island and backing away from the island as she's immigrating away from Ireland. And it was the first poem where, oh man, this is modern day language. She's just starting out with a declarative sentence. I have two daughters. Wow, I totally understand what she's saying. They're all I ever wanted. I totally get that. She's not being cryptic at all. This was like the very end of my senior year. So it was too late for me to switch into a poetry major or anything else. But after I graduated, I started getting more interested in writing. And then through a series of serendipitous mishaps, I wound up taking a class with Brendan Constantine at Idlewild Arts. Brendan has such a big personality, and at the time I was really lost and going, what do I do with my life? And I was watching what he was doing, and he looked like he was having so much fun, but it was also very meaningful fun. So that's when I started really studying poetry in earnest. And I was an English teacher for 4 years studying poetry just on the side, as I think we all can relate to that. I was still looking for other work. I was still trying to think, how do I make a living? Poetry was just something I was going to do on the side until I became really big, and then maybe I could teach at a university or something. But then when I moved down to LA and I got that pushcart nomination, I'm like, no, I can do it now. I don't have to wait. I don't have to wait till I have an MFA or I have a book out. I know what I'm doing. I have a couple interesting awards under my belt. I'm going to start teaching it now because I feel ready.
I was wondering what made you want to major in English at that age?
Yeah, that's a good question. you think you know what you want, and you've got to look at what it is you actually do. I thought I wanted to be in performing arts, but when it came time to declare a major, I was like, it's kind of ridiculous to go to college and get a degree in performing arts. You have all these academic subjects and all of these academic leaders. And so I'm going to study English because I really loved English classes and I love novels and I love books. And I have a minor in performing arts. I remember this really clearly. There was a point when I took a class in economics because I'm like, I want to make money for a living. That's what I want to do. And I took one class in economics. And it wasn't that difficult. But at the end, I turned to one of my friends and I'm, yeah, I don't care about money that much. I'd rather live in a cardboard box than have to take 4 more years of classes like this. So that's when I decided I was going for the title of my degree is Modernist Studies, English with an emphasis in Modernist Studies.
And how often were you writing during that time?
How often was I writing during that time? I was pretty dedicated as a writer. I traveled around the East Coast of the United States for about 3 months, I think, and I kept a notebook and I was working on a play and I was writing some observations. I wrote a play and a rough draft of a children's book in that time. And I think with my life, the only thing I really ever do is work and write and go to coffee shops and then write in the coffee shops. And occasionally I'll go see a movie or go out to dinner with friends. But that is all that I really spend my time doing.
So what happened with the children's book? It's just sitting on your computer, or do you have plans for it?
It's in a notebook somewhere, and to be completely honest, I think I've thrown that notebook away. I wish I hadn't. I think there was some good stuff in it, but I finished it and was, I don't need to hold on to this. It was a practice book.
So when was your first Pushcart nomination? Was it in your mid-20s?
I think I was 28 at the time. Mm-hmm. So far, it's my only Pushcart nomination, but having just the one...
Even one is impressive.
Yeah, and I'm not disparaging it. I am hoping one day to have another Pushcart nomination, but that one was enough to get me going and give me the confidence boost I needed. But it was also really challenging because after getting that Pushcart nomination, it froze me up and I became hypercritical of my writing. And I started taking it really seriously. Yeah. I'd open my laptop and look at the blank page and just be like, what would a Pushcart nominated poet write today? I am a serious writer and I write serious writing. And then I just stare at the blank page and go, nothing is good enough.
So once you took Brendan's class, and Brendan Constantine is somebody who could make anyone love poetry, I think.
Yes.
Who else did you work with or study with?
Oh, man, I've had some really good teachers. I started studying with Sally Ashton in the Bay Area, and then I started working with Kim Adonizio, who I think really influenced the way that I look at poetry and edit poetry. I've studied with Jack Grapes down here in Los Angeles. I've worked with Eloise Klein Healy and Sarah McClay. I've taken one workshop from Matthew Dickman. You're always learning from people, even if you're not directly studying with them. You read their books. I'm very grateful to every poet who's written a how-to book because I've learned something from them. I've read Richard Hugo's The Triggering Town and Ted Kooser's Poetry Home Pair Manual, and I think those are super helpful books.
Can I add something about that, Tricia?
Yeah.
You were the person who I remember when we had first met and you were teaching these editing workshops, and I was in awe of you. And I remember I asked if I could buy you a coffee, and we met at the Earth Cafe. And I was just, how do I write? How do I do this? How do I become a poet? And you recommended those two books, and they changed my life. I think that sometimes people give me a list of books and I read them and I'm like, okay, but those are two of the best that I have ever seen. And I owe so much to your guidance in those areas, your guidance in general, but specifically in those texts. They were super helpful.
Thank you. Thank you. And yeah, one of the things that I've learned about being a mentor in poetry, I don't feel like I know all that much, but I know where to direct people to find the other people who know more. I feel that half of my job is just being a good librarian and saying, oh, you need to learn about imagery? Go check out Mark Doty. He is the guy for imagery. And oh, you wanna write poems just about sound? Go read Hugo's The Triggering Town. That guy is obsessed with the sounds of words. Go look at him. That's my ethos about writing and teaching.
That's what a good teacher does, though, in college, too. Okay. You know, when you get your master's.
So, Tricia, I'm wondering how you have had, like, kind of a very interesting and adventurous foray into writing, being that you've studied with a lot of people, you started fairly young and had some great success. I'm wondering how your writing and your practice has changed over the years.
To be honest, when I first started writing, I was very undisciplined, I think, and I wasn't reading enough really good poets. I was just throwing spaghetti at the wall. Mm-hmm. I would be like, just words. I'm going to do a lot of automatic writing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what came out from my automatic writing was just blather. If it's strange and it doesn't make sense, that makes it a poem. And I'd read my strange writing that didn't make any sense. And I'd just be all like, why isn't that a poem? What is the difference between the gibberish I'm writing and The Second Coming? Yeah. And I think when I started taking poetry workshops, and the first real poetry workshop I took was with Sally Ashton. She was teaching from a book called Structure and Surprise, mm-hmm. edited by Michael Tooney, who I just love. And that book really opened up doors for me and made me understand the form of a poem. And at the time, I was also working with teenagers and preteens and teaching English. So I was getting a lot of the really, really very rudimentary basic writing techniques like imagery and metaphor. And I was reading these chapters on imagery and metaphor that were meant to help sixth graders understand what imagery was and why it was important. So that gave me a really, really solid foundation in the actual craft. And as time has gone on, I've learned so much more about craft. And I think a lot of people think like you're either born a poet or you're not a poet and you can't learn it. And I think that's total bupkis. If you want to learn it, just get a book on craft and try teaching it to sixth graders 4 hours a day. To add in a little bit more here, I had a lot of students who were on the spectrum. They don't learn things intuitively like some of the rest of us do. So you have to really logically spell it out. When you say, my love is like a red, red rose, okay, you don't understand what the emotional context of that is. Well, what's a rose? What can we say about a rose? Can we describe it? What's your association? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? When would you use a rose? When would you give someone a rose? Oh, you'd give someone a rose to show that you love them. Ergo, my love is like a red, red rose means my love is beautiful. My love is special. My love is a gift. And you have to really, really break everything down in its most logical components. And doing that for 4 hours a day for 4 years helped me understand craft in a way I never would have understood it mm-hmm. if I was just trying to go intuitively.
Mm. Right.
So now to answer your question, Kelly, first part of my life, I was just throwing words at the paper, trying to make them stick. And now I'm a lot more intentional and I use a lot more craft and I love to find new writing techniques. But it's still a mystery. I can write in a way that's a lot more poetic and makes use of a lot more craft technique. But when I'm going to use craft to say something that's really true or emotionally resonant, that's still something I am always struggling with.
That's really interesting because I started with automatic writing as well when I was in my late teens, early 20s, and just just vomiting words on paper that didn't connect at all, but it felt good. And then when I would read it out loud at readings, no one would understand anything, but they were impressed because I used big words, even though I wasn't saying anything. So when did you know, what was the first poem that you wrote that you felt like, oh, it's all coming together now?
Yeah, the first poem I wrote, it wasn't the first poem I had published, but it was the first poem I wrote that later went on to be published, was called, last autumn, They Turned Yellow at First, Like Pieces of Torn Watercolor Paper That Had Absorbed Too Much Paint and Fell. I remember writing that before I started taking classes, definitely before I really knew anything about what I was doing. I was sitting at a cafe, I think at a Starbucks in Temecula, and it was fall. And fall is just such a poem time of year.
That's a great poem.
It is. I've been trying to write that poem for a while about every autumn is a poem town.
I love the ending. I love how you end the poem.
Yeah, thank
Artemis
you.
Artemis dying in the gutter. So that's really cool.
Thank you. Yeah, I look at it now. There's a reference in there to Artemis. And I'm like, come on, Trisha, the Greeks. That's so trite. But at the time, that was what I had to work with. But yeah, it was autumn and the leaves were turning. And I mean, I was 20, I was probably 21 or 22 at that time, but I was just feeling, wow, time passes. It's another autumn. Summer is over. The leaves are falling. The season is changing. Death is upon us. How do I capture this before it's gone? And then it just always feels like you look up, the leaves are yellow. You bend down to tie your shoelaces. You look it up again and they're gone completely. Yeah. And it's winter. And just that sense that time passes so quickly, I think, is what really stirs me to want to write poetry.
That is such a metaphor for life. You know, one thing I notice about you that I am jealous of is your ability to recite and memorize. You remember the first four lines of that poem. As I Googled it up, I was, oh my gosh, how is she doing this? Can you talk a little bit about that, if it's conscious or unconscious, if it's something that you work on, if you think maybe it's your theater background?
That's something, I think in a lot of ways, that's something I've been blessed with. I remember, like, first of all, I cannot remember my mom's birthday to this day. But if I hear a line of poetry that I really like, it sticks with me. If I remember a fact that's really interesting, it sticks with me. And I think that's something that I'm just naturally blessed with. I don't consciously memorize poems most of the time. I've never actually tried to memorize one of my own poems. But usually if there's just one line, you know, and if I've read it over and over because I'm working on it and submitting it, it can't help but stick with me. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of Kim Rosen, who wrote a book called Saved by a Poem, where she talks about not memorizing a poem, but learning it by heart and writing it on your bones, sort of like the emotionally resonant, life-changing process of learning them by heart, and how you can change your breath and change your mind and change your whole being by learning and reciting and re-reciting poems.
Absolutely. You put yourself, I guess, in the writer's shoes in many ways.
Yeah.
It really, I think, puts you in the spirit where you're not just reading it on the page, but you're the poem and the poet are inside you. You are keeping them safe. It's a weird thing when I memorize a poem completely. It's like I folded a secret note and left it inside me.
So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Trisha is going to discuss one of the most organic or easy poems that has come to her and a poem that she has wrestled with a bit. Stay tuned.
We'll get back to our interview in just a moment. In the meantime, if you want to get more support for your own writing or learn more about the craft of poetry, check out our services at www.thepoetrysalon.com. You can learn more about poetry by taking one of our e-courses or get feedback on your own writing by joining one of our editing classes.
The Poetry Salon is a community of intrepid writers who support one another through in-person and online services.
One more time, that's thepoetrysalon.com. You can also reach me directly with any questions that you have at Tricia@thepoetrysalon.com.
Now, back to our podcast.
Speaking of poems we memorize and your first poem or one of the first poems last autumn that made you feel like you're combining craft and intuition, what is a poem that you worked on that kind of wrote itself? It was really easy to write. It was like a gift from the muses.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and I'm going to read both an easy poem and a really difficult poem. So the first one is Swan in the City. A gray one crosses my path, flying low through the smog of Los Angeles. Of course, it might have been a goose or a lone mallard lifting like a ship into the clouds of the mid-city streetlights. But I prefer to think it was a swan, discolored with soot from our fair industrial city, quick past the reflective glass, quick past the coffee shops and face-down children searching for quarters in the cracks of the sidewalk, quick over my car, ruffling the afternoon with her indefinite feathers. I like to think I conjured it with all of my thoughts about swans, a gray bird grieving for its natural habitat, swan with rain sliding down the doors of its eyes, swan with fish and feathers, swan the intimate North American size of its wings and bright black feet, a swan creator of lost souls, like in Alaska, parting the sky open, pushing the mist aside and sliding into the marshes, my swan, bringing me all I have lost about mountains, all I have lost from the bottle of wine, all I have lost slinking through the city, guilty Virgin Mary, Mother May I, Amelia Earhart, its swollen bird breast navigating what I cannot understand or see through. I am afraid of getting lost without my GPS, my map, my cell phone, a dumb animal shot down by beliefs. But the swan lifts her 8 million filaments of feather, her lost chicks, her dead brother, the swamps of the north, the slick black mud of her birth, the frozen tundra, out of whatever pool she is swimming in this morning and rises, rises, rises into the skyline, past the buildings that reflect her. A quick slash of silhouette and shape against the hardened glass. A brief moment of motion and light. Swan, without your flying through us, we would all fall out of this world.
Wow. Gorgeous.
Thank you. So that was Swan in the City.
Okay.
And for my next trick, I'm going to read a poem called Cartography Test. It's a little hard sometimes to read this poem because the way it lays on the page, it looks a little bit like a kid's test. There's questions and then the kid fills in the answers. So just imagine that what I'm reading is a question and response on a test.
Almost cartography. Like a vocabulary test?
Yeah, like a vocabulary test.
Where you write the definition. Right?
Yeah. So it looks like a vocabulary test for cartography-related words.
Mm-hmm.
Cartography test. Map. Something sepia-toned, full of sea monsters. It tells you where you want to be, everywhere you are afraid to go. Cartographer. A boy looking out a window, dreaming about sex and butterflies. He is looking for the right passage. He is looking for lost keys. He is looking for you. Isthmus. In a large body of water, two narrow strips of love with death on either side. Cross at night, cross at morning, sleep long sleeps in the gusty afternoon. Ocean. Something for whales to swim in. the eye of the same boy looking out the window, dreaming about sex, a large body of water, a large communication network for whales who sing to each other from entire hemispheres away. Hemisphere, an imaginary line. Imaginary line. All lines are imaginary. Even the map is an invention, a basket we wove to hold the entire world. Continents. What holds the body holds the mountains. A place to find moose and lizards, tea roses and butterflies, about which a boy is dreaming when he looks out the window, imagining the seas parting for the clean slicing bow of his ship. Compass rose, a flower, the blossoming of discovery. The first boat broke through the water like a floret cutting the soil. Wherever way it was pointed, that was the way home.
Mm, what an ending.
Yes.
I love how you encompass the whole entire world in every poem you write. I think that you do such a great job of zooming us in and zooming us out. We go from macro to micro and different worlds and universes and dreams. So I just want to tell you how moved I am by that.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if you can talk to us about how you do that easily and how you might struggle with that. Which was which?
Should we guess? Should we guess first, Kelly?
Which one do you think was the easy one?
I think the second one was your easy one.
Yeah, that's what I think too. I know about your reverence for swans. So I think there was some pressure perhaps in like giving it justice, but I know you personally.
Well, in a way, you're both right and you're both totally wrong.
Story of my life.
Well, I'll explain. The swan one, in all honesty, I can't even remember where I was when I wrote that. So it must be easy, because if it were difficult, I'd remember all the struggles. Yes, you're right, Kelly. I go through these phases where I get hooked on a certain animal and then I just want to write about that animal over and over. And I was really meditating on swans for a while. And I found that is really interesting. And I didn't know this before choosing the swan for the poetry logo, but I think it was Pythagoras said that swans are the souls of dead poets migrating from earth to heaven.
Wow.
That's really cool.
And I'd read this poem by Mary Oliver called The Swan, and I think that's what got me really obsessed with them for a while, and that's why I chose the swan as the logo for the Poetry Salon. But I was driving to work one day in Los Angeles on the 405, and I was probably thinking about swans because I was thinking about her poem and that variety of different ways that I think about swans during the day. This is what I do when I get stuck in traffic. I just stop and I think about swans.
I love it.
And a bird flew really low, really close to my window. And it could have been a goose, but I was thinking about swans and it was a big white bird. And I thought it might also be a swan. And you usually don't see geese flying alone. You see them in flocks. And I almost thought, oh my God, I've just been thinking about swans. I'm hallucinating them now.
That line about, I think I conjured it, or I hope I conjured it. I love that.
Yeah.
So I know that when I sat down to write this, and it may have been in a writing class or it may have been just the writing that I did that morning, it was really easy because all I was doing was starting with that moment. The swan crosses my path, flying low through the smog of Los Angeles. It might have been a goose or a lone mallard. And I mean, that was just what was naturally going through my head. I was just reporting my own thought process. As I went and continued to write about that moment, I just included a lot of similes and a lot of metaphors. And then came to that line, Swan, without your flying through us, we would all fall out of this world. And I think in some ways that was really something I owed to Mary Oliver. Like, it's not a direct copy of any of her lines, but it's the ending of Mary Oliver's poem is, after she describes this swan, she says, "Do you know what beauty is for, and have you changed your life?" And I was thinking, having beautiful things in poems, in art, is part of what makes life worth living, and all I really want to do with my life. So it was kind of a turnaround on that with the beauty, with the swan, with this beautiful swan in my presence, in my sight. It's what keeps me wanting to be part of this world. I hadn't really realized that until just now, trying to explicate it.
I noticed Mary Oliver influences you a lot. Like, your next book might be titled
You Do Not Have to Be Good.
Yeah, which is from the
Wild Geese.
Wild Geese, Mary, again, swan, geese, apparently webbed birds, webbed feet are your inspiration, your muse. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
This is something Mark Doty talks about in his book, The Art of Description, and he talks about Elizabeth Bishop's poem where she describes a fish. Animals can't really speak, and they're very mysterious, and we really can't understand what it's like to be, say, a fish. So I think that mystery opens up a lot of potentials for poetry. I think for myself, animals are a great metaphor for certain aspects of ourselves. When I was younger and I was much more isolated, I was writing about whales constantly because whales are solitary creatures and they travel alone. They communicate through sonar, and that's very much how I was feeling at the time. So a whale was a really good way for me to explore my feelings about that. Lately, I've been thinking a lot about crows, which has given rise to my next book, which has a lot of crows repeating. I think when I was developing the Poetry Salon, especially, I was really thinking about what's the purpose of a poem? Why would anyone want to pay money to learn about poetry? And so I was thinking about the necessity for beauty, and that's why I was swan obsessed for a long time. I think animals are just a great way to get some emotional mystery going.
I agree. I think we also, as humans, we want to imagine the unexplained.
Yeah.
So because there's no dialogue, I know that poem about Elizabeth Bishop, and it's all of the rusted hooks and the whiskers, and it like talks about the battle that this fish has been through. I think that poetry is seeking or searching for an answer or a way to process it all, and I think we do the same with animals. So it seems like a really natural marriage. There's something so healing about animals to us.
Yeah. So we both want to talk for them.
Yeah.
And we also, we want to project our own feelings onto them. They evoke that feeling because they don't talk. I mean, if they talked, I think we wouldn't be able to project our own feelings onto them so easily.
Right.
I'm projecting right now onto swans. I'm reading about swans. I didn't know that swans can die of a broken heart.
Oh. Swans, is that true?
They only have one partner for their entire life. If their partner dies, they could in fact die of heartbreak.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Isn't that one of the most poetic things you've ever heard about animals?
Just animals are so fascinating in general, their capacity that we like overlook. There's so much that they'll say, oh, so-and-so has the species has a brain the size of the pea, but then you read something like that and you're just, oh, you're cracked open. So Tricia, I am interested in hearing about the difficult poem, perhaps. I'm not quite sure if the swan poem was Swan in the City. It was both easy and difficult, I think you're saying, correct?
No, it was the cartography test. So I'll tell you why it was really difficult. And I think you hit on it, Kelly. I try to encompass the entire world in every poem I write, which is actually really challenging. The world is very big, and poems are quite small. When I was younger, I taught at this school where I was a one-room schoolhouse, and I taught history and literature to grades 6 through 12. And every year I was teaching a different subject in history and social studies. So I've like literally taught from the dawn of human existence all the way up to the 2012 election. That's a lot of history to cover. And a lot of it is stuff that I've known for a very long time, you know, World War I, World War II. But studying ancient and medieval history gave me a lot of strangeness to think about. And, you know, going back to our discussion about animals, it's very similar studying ancient civilizations, because these are civilizations that some of them left written records and some of them left artifacts. But for the most part, they're still very mysterious. We don't really have anyone from that time period who's here to answer questions for us. So I was very interested and confused and confronted by the lack of knowing about things on our own planet. I think I was teaching geography and I was teaching ancient civilizations at the same time. There's just all this stuff in the world that I'd never heard about before or that's really mysterious to us. Like there's a sculpture of a black Jesus that washed up on a shore somewhere, I think in South America. No one knows who carved it. No one knows why it's black. No one knows where it came from. They just discovered, I think maybe 2 years ago in the Netherlands, this bog of human beings who have spears in their sides, and clearly it was the site of some great big battle. But what's really interesting is the skeletons and the spears are much older than people believed that humans were making weapons. So it's like we've actually been making weapons a lot longer than most science realized. So there's all this mystery in the world, and I was trying to make sense of all of it. Couldn't just pick one civilization or one continent to focus on. I'm just like, the whole of it, everything buried under the earth that we don't know about. I want to write a poem about that. I was reading a poem by Bernadette Mayer called Between House and Bernadette, where the poet Bernadette Mayer is having a conversation with her house, and it's this back and forth, and it's kind of funny, and it's like, you know, why all the laundry piled up? Why all the letters piled up? Well, I don't like opening them, and your kid makes too much noise. Well, he's a young boy, you know, so it's all about this very quotidian stuff. So I was trying to have a conversation between me and a map of the world, trying to come to some logic, some kind of resolution. It was so not working. Just the poem kept expanding and expanding. Every time I read about something new or interesting in history that was mysterious, I'd put it in, and it was just getting to be big and way too heavy. And I was working on that for like 4 to 5 years. And I was working with the poet Sarah McClay, who was helping me with some poems. She suggested a couple of different exercises, and one of them was to try to write a test format. So like a true or false test or multiple choice test. And I thought, okay, this is a map. What kind of class would you be studying a map in? Cartography test. And I started looking up all the different terms that you would have to know if you were a professional cartographer, or if you were taking cartography lessons. And so that's where this poem came from, but only after 3 years of trying to fit it into the wrong form.
So it's kind of like a key, you know, once you find the right lock, it all kind of clicks, but it takes a while for you to just kind of keep on trying and trying and trying.
Some poems, you get them and they're there, and the form is really good, and you've said everything you need to say, and then it's a matter of cutting things out or rearranging things to make it flow nicely. Mm-hmm. And I think you've pointed this out in a lot of my work. A lot of poems start out with me just talking about the landscape or something really beautiful and intriguing, but there's no urgency to it. It's just 20 pages of me talking about how pretty the roses are. And then maybe I'll drop in one thing about my mother never loved me, which is not true, but I mean, that would be an example of a line that would really be the emotional resonance of a poem. And then it's a matter of having to go back and like explore that more. And so when I get those poems that are really challenging, where I know I'm interested in something, but I can't figure out what I need to say about it, I will often try different forms over and over and over until I finally hit the right form.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's very frustrating because it's like I've got 10 different drafts of a poem about the Rose Garden and none of them are getting anywhere. But other times it can be really great. Like with my first chapbook, I was trying to write a poem about a whale and I couldn't figure out what I was trying to say for like 5 years. So I kept writing different versions of the same poem over and over. And each time they became a different aspect of the whale and they became a different, totally different poem on the same subject. So what wound up happening is that I had an entire chapbook of poems that were on a similar topic and had a recurring motif. So it's like, it's awesome if you're trying to write a full book.
So I'm wondering, Tricia, you and I have such completely different revision styles. Sometimes you'll be like, I revised this poem, can you take a look? And I'm like, wait, I've read this poem before. It's usually completely different. There might be one line outside of form and reaching for different forms and different packaging. Can you tell us other methods or modalities that you use for revision?
Yeah, I was thinking about that too, like a more general thing. I look for one really key line in a poem. Maybe I'm just doing a free write, and then I say one really true line that winds up being the ending line to a poem. And I'm like, I know that I want that to be the ending line. Now I have to go back and write an entirely new poem that sets up this ending line appropriately. And sometimes it's not that arduous. It'll be a long poem with a lot of different things going on. And then I look at it in the cold light of day, or I'll show it to a writing group or to you. And you're like, well, this feels like this is the most important line. This looks like it's the thesis. So then I look at everything else around the poem and I go, does this support the thesis? Does this hit that topic? Is it a counterpoint to the thesis? Is it related in some way? Yes, great, I'll keep it. No, it has nothing to do with it. I'm going to cut this line and either throw it away or put it in my scrap pile.
Yeah, sometimes you tell me, you're like, so just rewrite it entirely. And I'm always, oh. But I think that you have a lot of new things that are revealed through the course of that.
Yeah. But I think a lot of that, too, is when I first started writing, one of the first books I read was Structure and Surprise, which is all about how to structure a poem. So I think I learned early on to have a healthy respect for structure. But also, my mind is just really wild and big and disorganized. And right, I'm trying to contain the entire universe often in a small space. For me, I need structure in order to get things into a small, digestible place. Structure is really important to me because I don't necessarily have it as a natural guiding force in my life, which is why usually it's the structure that's lacking in my first drafts. And so it's the structure that I need when I work on a second or third draft. I think that's actually part of why I love poetry so much, too, because my mind is wild and crazy and going in all different directions. And poetry is a way for me to settle it down and find a form for all the chaos.
Same, same, same. It's such a great friend in that way, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great. It is just like, my mind is too chaotic. In fact, I think when I'm not feeling really engaged with writing and I'm not feeling like it's necessary to write, it's not always a bad thing. It's usually like, oh yeah, I've done all the dishes and everything in my life is okay. And that's why traveling really instigates writing for me, because I'm always in a new place and there's so much new stuff to consume. I can't take vacations in other locations, because as soon as I get to another location and there's a bird I look at that I don't know the name of, I have to sit down and write about the strangeness of that bird so I can contain the chaos of it in my mind.
Wonderful. Armine, any final questions that you have as we wrap up?
I know I read one of your manuscripts and it was lovely, and that book's coming out, right? The Worm book?
Oh, yeah, Raven and Worm. Well, so I finished Raven and Worm, which I think both of you have looked at. That's another one where just crows and ravens kept showing up. I've been looking at them and my relationship to them and studying the history of how they've appeared in mythology and things like that. And I just kept writing poems where they kept showing up until I had 60 pages. And then I showed them to you guys and you're like, these pages work and these ones don't, and keep working on this and just abandon that. And I boiled it down to, I think it's now like 50 pages that I hope are a little tighter. I don't know that that's how everyone else works. It's more fashionable now to have books that are more tightly connected and tightly related, so they're all on the same theme. But I think in generations past, you wrote poems about multiple subjects, and like every few years, you're just, yeah, these are the poems I finished this year. They're in a collection. None of these poems are related, except that they're all the poems that I wrote in the last couple of years.
I think that might be an MFA trend.
Is it?
I think, because that's what I was encouraged to do when I was writing my book for the MFA program.
Armine, they told you that you needed to have poems that were all kind of in the same like theme or collection or around the same topic?
They didn't say I had to, like, oh, you'll get a bad grade.
Right. But they encouraged.
But they encouraged, yeah, like, what is it? What is this book telling the world? Is it about immigration? Is it about trauma? Is it about swans? They encouraged us to have some kind of thread going through the book. It's strange how things change in art from decade to decade.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit, like, there's definitely advantages to that and disadvantages. Like, I love that I get to take a subject and just explore it from many different angles and obsess over it, because I kind of like that. But when it comes to putting your book together, it makes it so much harder. I would love to be able to put together a collection and just say, these are the poems that I wrote this year, or these are the poems I wrote over the last 3 years. There's 50 of them. That's a good number for a book. And I'm just going to put them in the order that I wrote them. And they're all independent poems, so there's no reason why they have to agree with each other or flow together. Just stop. Stop between each poem and go for a walk and come back, because they don't relate. It's not a novel. One page does not have to relate to the other page. Yeah. I think that would be so much easier. I would love that.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Everything is subjective in art.
Let's undo this trend. Let's bring chaos back to the poetry world.
Or even just variety, switching perspectives. It's nice. I think it's nice to shake it up a little bit. Because in terms of what they call like project books, I feel like sometimes you exhaust a theme. And when I say you, I mean me. You know, sometimes it feels like, oh, man, how much can I write about this thing and keep it fresh and new? And that's the challenge of writing, of course. But
to me, it's not fun.
Yeah.
It's not fun to write poetry with an agenda, like a book report.
Mm-hmm.
I think my book was, I just wrote and wrote and wrote and then noticed a thread.
Yeah.
It came up organically. Yeah. So what do you think, Tricia, about your second book? Is it something that's a different kind of process?
Yeah, so with this poem, The Cartography Test, what actually happened is when I found different forms, plural, I wound up writing three different poems that were on the subject of kind of having a dialogue with the map. I didn't know which one of them was the best, so I showed all three of them to Sarah McClay, and she said these are all different enough from each other. They can be three different poems. And so when you have three different poems that are on a similar theme, they became kind of the backbone and the vertebrae of the book that I'm working on. Everything else sort of comes into a line around it. You know, it's all about being in my 20s and trying to figure out where I fit in the world and discovering what the world is really like. Because I've grown up in a lot of small towns and I feel like I've led a very sheltered life. So like coming out into the world and living in Washington, D.C. for a while and going from small town to big city and seeing like homeless people and war and paying attention to the news. I mean, it's all very shocking. And then studying the depth of history and the depravity and the capability of human beings is really something that was very hard to grapple with. So I went back through my manuscript and I was just picking poems that had that flavor to them, that coming of age kind of flavor to them. Or I think as Kelly wrote in the comments of one of my books, I really like this, is my, it's a coming of place book as opposed to a coming of age book. It's a coming of place book.
Oh, that's cool.
Which is funny because I don't remember writing that at all. Isn't it always funny when people are like, oh yeah, you gave me this piece of feedback and it really, and I'm like, yeah, that's great. I don't remember that at all. I think that if someone wanted a way, like a course in life on how to fall in love with a place, they should talk to you because you just do such a great job of romancing a location, all its sensory detail. And I appreciate that so much about your work. Every time I read a poem of yours, I'm like, yeah, Los Angeles is amazing. So I think that for me, it's I travel through your work and it's so refreshing to me.
Yeah, I really should have been a travel agent. If I had discovered that you could be a travel agent before I discovered poetry, that'd totally be my life's work right now. But I'm a travel agent through poetry. In answering your question, Armine, I looked at what themes were naturally present in the poems, and then it's led to more poetry that's consciously and intentionally about that coming of age, coming of place stuff. But I'll tell you, that can be really challenging and derailing. Mm-hmm. When you consciously know what you're writing about, it feels like homework. And it feels I'm not organically interested in this. I don't have something to say about this. But I feel like this is something I'm obligated to talk about in this book because it's a missing piece. I don't know if that's absolutely necessary to do that.
That's how they work. And everyone's process is different. And others, we just need to write about everything, get the chaos on the page, like you said, and then go back and see what comes out of the poems.
And I think that's the more organic way to go about it.
So the next book you're writing is You Do Not Have to Be Good. And it's a book of poetry, not a textbook.
No, that one, it's kind of half memoir and half advice book. I think of it like the book Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott. Kind of dealing with the emotional aspects of being a writer and dealing with rejection and dealing with not being good enough and having the better mindset for being a writer.
Personal essays and like Bird by Bird or The Triggering Town, but in a much different vein.
Yeah, it'll give some direct advice on how to enhance your writing practice and your creative practice and how to enhance a creative environment for students. There will be some direct advice, but it's not going to be so much about craft as it is about the internal struggles and how you can facilitate the best kind of conditions for creativity in your own life and in a classroom. And then people who get that should also get my book, Method and Mystery, which is all about the craft aspect and creating prompts that are really helpful and useful to bringing people into poetic places.
I think that anyone who's looking for some kind of writing discipline, if you're trying to write even once a week, maybe every morning, whatever that looks like, Method and Mystery is so wonderful because what you get to do is you get to read this amazing poem. Then you get to see how Tricia breaks down the elements of how to build that poem. So, and then write a prompt around that poem. I think that that book really, for me and all of your prompts, it really helps me understand what the poet is doing so much more clearly than if someone's just like, write a poem about the grief of your mother. Here are the tools that the poet has used, and here you can take these tools but reconstruct with your own angle or subject matter or whatever it is. I just think Method and Mystery is so brilliant. When I don't know what to write, I just open up the book and read a poem and do the prompt.
And you can open it up at any part of the book.
Yeah, it's not like, okay, did I read this chapter? Do I know what's going on? It's very kind of plug and play. And I think it's a cure-all for any kind of poetic writer's block. And what I like to do, I got this from your editing workshops, Tricia, is when you would give us a poem and a prompt like that in 15 minutes, I felt like the pressure was really on. So when I write with Method and Mystery, I set my timer for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
That way I don't sit there and I'm like, oh, what will I write about this, know that. I'm like, okay, 15 minutes, I got to get a poem out. I don't know. I just think it's such a valuable tool.
Thank you. And, you know, on that note, I will say, I think the time in my life when I was most prolific was when I was teaching 5 different classes at the high school, junior high, and I was in graduate school, and I was trying to keep up an active writing practice all at the same time, because I didn't have time to dilly-dally. I didn't have time to be all like, am I going to write? No, you know, I think I'll watch YouTube videos for an hour. I'd be all like, there is no time. If I do not write now, it will not happen. I will write. I will listen to YouTube videos while I'm cooking dinner or taking a shower. But this time is for writing because it's my only 15 minutes of the day. I better use it.
So before we close, and the effort of being great writers and great readers, I'm always looking for new poems or poets that blow my hair back. Is there a poem or a poet that you are obsessed with at the moment, Tricia?
Right now, I think what I have been getting really into is not so much a specific poet, but I've been really interested in reading poems that are sonnets or American sonnets or sonnet-like poems. And part of that is because I've been getting more and more interested in learning poems by heart. And of course, a poem that is only 14 lines or around 14 lines is a little less daunting. But there's so much you can do with it. And right now, the poem, a singular poem that I think I'm obsessed with, is called Woods by Noelle Oxenhandler. I think it's just 12 to 14 lines. I'm going to recite it because it's really short. I wish to grow dumber, to slip deep into the woods that grow blinder with each step I take, until the fingers let go of their numbers and the hands are finally ignorant as paws. Unable to count the petals, I will not know who loves me, who loves me not. Nothing to remember, nothing to forgive. I will stumble into the juice of the berry, the shag of bark. I will be dense and happy as fur.
I
just love that poem. And I think, you know, in a world where we are often writing about our pain and our emotional struggles and our family challenges, what I love about that poem is that it shows me how to write a poem that is rooted in possible happiness. And poems are all about moving a person from one place to another. And a lot of the time we can move from despair to joy. We can move from secrecy to revelation. A lot of the time, I think we're moving from, like, you know, it's a day at the beach, and then I remember we're all going to die. That's what my first poem, Last Autumn, is about. I'm looking at the leaves turn yellow, and I remember we're all going to die. Moving from the everyday quotidian world to the deeper realizations that we have. And I love this poem because it just moves us from being human back to being animal and kind of letting go of all the human challenges and the resentments. And, like, we let our fingers let loose of the numbers until they are as happy and ignorant and as paws. Nothing to remember, nothing to forgive. It's a poem about letting go completely. And especially right now, because it's summertime, I'm just like, I want to be a bear. I want to go into the woods and eat berries all day long.
Doesn't that sound wonderful?
Oh.
When I want to sleep and eat when I want to eat. Thank you so much for this. I always learn so much talking to you. And I think that talking to you is such a joy because I fall in love with poetry all over again.
Yeah, that I felt the same way when I took your first class. I felt joy.
Oh, thank you. I definitely love poetry. And the only thing I love more than poetry itself is getting to be around other poets. So really, I'm just a mirror. I'm just letting you bounce your own joy off of me. And so thank you very much for chatting with me today and sharing your energy and getting us all to talk about poetry together.
It was fun. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
You have been listening to an interview of poet Tricia Faye Heffner, whose most recent book is Method and Mystery, a research-based guide to teaching poetry, plus 60 original prompts to take your students deeper. In Method and Mystery, Tricia Faye Heffner, MA Humanistic Psychology Creativity Studies, and founder of teaching institute The Poetry Salon, explores the fascinating, unpredictable, and enriching process of facilitating a poetry writing workshop. Both teachers and writers alike can gain clear insight into how to create the ideal conditions to access that most mysterious of realms, the place from which inspiration springs. Michelle Bidding, author of Broken Kingdom, says, "With masterful skill and deep sensitivity to the needs of both writers and instructors, Tricia Heffner's Method and Mystery offers a step-by-step guide to the pleasures of writing poetry that is at once practical, magical, and entirely doable. Readers will find her exercises and examples a delightful tonic for navigating the exciting but sometimes overwhelming creative writing waters. Heffner makes it feel easy, if not fundamental, to an inspired life in the arts. This generous manual is essential to anyone considering a career in mentoring poets at all stages of their writing practice." Method and Mystery is available on Amazon.com.
Thanks to our sound editor and production manager, one-man tech department, Alan Rubenstein, for help on all things computer.
Remember, you can also check us out at thepoetrysalon.com or on the Poetry Salon's YouTube channel, where you can get access to selected poetry readings, prompts, recorded blog posts, and more.
If you want to stay in touch, ask us questions, or suggest a poet for us to interview, message us at Tricia@thepoetrysalon.com or Kelly@thepoetrysalon.com, or you can message us on our Poetry Salon Facebook page.
To help us spread the word about the Saloncast and about poetry in general, subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also tell a friend, share this on social media, or hire a plane to write a message about us in the sky.
If you want to support our poetry community and get more support for your own writing, become a Patreon member.
That's right. For $1 a month on Patreon, we'll send you a new writing prompt with a new technique every week.
And for $5 a month, we'll give you an honest, useful, in-depth look at how we use the revision techniques we got on this podcast to rewrite our old drafts.
There is no guarantee what you'll see will be pretty.
Or finished.
Or free of typos.
But it will be honest. And you'll learn some fun new ways to get a fresh perspective on your old drafts. Until next time, Saloncast listeners, stay creative and remember, whoever writes the worst draft wins.